Common Credentialing Rules Advisory Committee meeting, May 23rd, 2017. Recorder on. Okay, so I want to go around the room and capture who's here and folks on the phone. So we'll start in the room. Again, Melissa Zaborn, OHA, and Mark, why don't you start?
Mark Bonanno, Oregon Medical Association.
Valerie Cruz, Providence
Health Nicole Krishnaswamy, Oregon Medical Board.
Amy Rossman, Healthshare of Oregon.
Hillary Park, Moda Health.
Kristen Downing, Providence.
Jennifer Gibbons, Providence.
Luke Wolowski, Oregon Health Authority.
And those on the phone?
Deb and Ann, Providence.
I got Deb and Ann. Hi, guys. Okay.
Mary Pullman, Providence.
Okay. Mary Pullman and Danielle?
Yes.
Okay. Great.
Trisha.
Hi, Trisha. Okay.
Melanie, Hattie, Clabby, Regents.
Hattie, and then Melanie Cookson?
Yep, and Karen okay. Dugan, Thomas Sante.
Ashley from Ogden.
Oh, hi. Glad you can make it. Okay. Anyone else on the line? All right. So today, last time we met for the rules meeting, we went over some details. So we only got a little bit into it. We only had an hour. Today we have 2 hours. We have a couple of heavier topics that I'd like to cover, and that includes delegation agreements and practitioner waivers. And by practitioner waivers, I mean waivers from doing the electronic submission of their application. So we know there's a need for a little bit of a paper process, and those would be extreme cases, like maybe absolutely no broadband connectivity. So there or some type of physical impairment or something. So I want to talk through those and how we capture that in rule, because we want to allow a hardship waiver, but we want to make sure that it's very narrow in definition. The idea is that we have a centralized electronic system and do away with the paper. So we want to think a little bit constructively about that. I guess we'll just, you know, go through one by one. We have made a few adjustments since the last time we met. So I will walk through those, and we've had some comments and suggestions, and so I will walk through those as well. Rebecca Pollack from Hospital Association just showed up, so we had another participant in the room. Okay, so getting straight to the rules. Everybody ready? Yay. And I don't have my copies of the rules in here. Do you have?
I can just go. I have extra.
The host is unprepared. Okay. So I think one of our main sticking points here that we discussed last time was the practitioner type list. And really the upshot of that conversation is it could be misconstrued as everyone in those practitioner types that we listed must participate. But not all of them are credentialed, and the intention of the legislation is just for those that are credentialed having to use the system. So what we did to clarify in that we tried to keep it simple. So on page 2 of the rules, top of the page, it's definition number 11. Healthcare practitioner means an individual authorized to practice a profession related to the provision of healthcare services in Oregon, for which the individual must be credentialed. So it's the individual must be credentialed. However, we further clarified, I just want to say that that is actual statutory language, so we can't change that. But we can change the second sentence and all below. So what we did is say this may include, but is not limited to, individuals licensed as, and then the list proceeds. So do we feel like that solves any misconception as to what that rule means?
Yes, I think it's more clear.
Okay. Anybody on the phone have any problems with that?
Seems reasonable to me.
Okay, great. Okay, we'll move off of that one. Health system, I will say we are still in those conversations, so we will not be doing with anything with that today. And again, you'll see in here that I made some clarifying changes, again, changing solution to system. I know folks have had a problem with the term solution in the past, and it does just make more sense to say system. We're clarifying that the OCCP is a program, and then there is a system within the program, rather than, I think in the beginning we classified solution as the program and the system. So I think this clears it up for folks. On page 3, under the main provisions of the Oregon Common Credentialing Program, number 1, an electronic solution. Number 2, process for healthcare practitioners. Number 3, a process for credentialing organizations. We used to have May input, access and retrieve healthcare practitioner credentialing information, but we will not be allowing for the input of information from credentialing organizations. There will be a component of the program that allows credentialing organizations to report information to the program that they may have on practitioners, performance or loss of some type of licensure. I don't know, that maybe we didn't catch. So we want to allow something for that, but that'll be kind of in our policies and procedures and outside of this rule. Doesn't need to be documented here. So we took that out. We also defined a number 4 process for regulatory boards to access healthcare practitioner information. That access means providing a flat file to our system. So their flat file will essentially access the system. We don't anticipate they will have, rights or profiles or master user accounts to input information. So we took that piece out of the rule. So that's that piece. Any questions on those? Okay. There's a lot of silly detail in here, but it's all important, and we just need to walk through
this. This is Hattie from Regis. I do have a question. So, I believe that if providing information was a significant part of this when it was originally introduced and discussed, so does that mean that all the provider's information is truly just self-reported from the provider?
Yes. Well, no. So, we will have healthcare regulatory board information to pre-populate the application, and we'll use whatever static verifications we can as long as they meet accrediting entity principles from the regulatory board. However, outside of that, it is the practitioner and the designee. It's the practitioner's responsibility, and the designee can assist with that. But at the end of the day, yes, practitioners have full ownership of this information. We don't intend to pre-populate the system with any other information. I know folks already have information in the MedVersant system, but that's all basically proprietary to or owned by the individual databases in the systems that it's used in. So we will not use that existing data. We would have to make agreements with those individual companies if we did that. And so practitioners do have full ownership. It's their responsibility.
Okay. Well, I'm also thinking, too, about practice location information. What address or mode of communication or however you're going to is going to be used in contacting providers as we all have, they practice differently depending on the organizations or payers that they're with.
I think we still need to cover some more of that detail. We'll be collecting everything in the OPCA, but we haven't talked about do we use the personal information, do we use their primary practice location. And so I think that there's still a little room to figure those pieces out, and that's you know, essentially how we need to work through credentialing policies with the vendor, because those are details that we haven't fully fleshed out. I will also add that designees, there will be some type of facility management tool available for designees so that they can go into the system and change their practice location. It will change across all the practitioners that they are a designee for. So we have that built into our requirements. So the details of how that works, I don't know. But I did want to point that out. I was thinking of that as you spoke. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Well, Michelle, this is Danielle.
Uh-huh.
So we're under Oregon Practitioner Credentialing Application section.
Uh-huh. Well, we're getting there, yeah. I think we can move on.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Are we there?
I think we can move on, unless anybody... Well, Nicole, did you have anything else in that piece?
I just had a question about something you just said about the information that will be pre-populated will only come from the medical boards and not from what they have already submitted to MedPerson.
Right.
So does that mean that they're going to need to do, like, their initial credentialing again with every one of the credentialers as though they're doing their first application?
It would be doing their first application, but they would not need to redo the initial application process with each of the individual organizations. So if they're already credentialed at the organizations that they've selected, it would just fill that profile for the credentialing organization. How I imagine it going down is the credentialing organization will pull the record so they can establish that relationship, but nothing would need to be done on the credentialing organization side unless they need to re-credential at that point. So it wouldn't be like going through a full credentialing process.
But they'll need to provide all of that initial information that
yes.
they did potentially when they were initially credentialed
yes.
20 years ago.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So go ahead, Danielle. I think we're ready.
Well, I guess I have a question. So we were in the section before. Sorry. For the section of the Oregon Common Credentialing Program.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay. Did I miss a comment? Or maybe I missed something. For number four, a process by which boards access healthcare practitioner credentialing information, I thought they were going to be putting stuff in.
Yeah. So I clarified that. We deemed the term access. They will be accessing the system to input their flat files.
Oh, okay.
So that's where we cut it off. They will not have their own user profile. They will not be able to input different pieces of information or change anything or anything like that. So that's why we took it out.
Okay. So then if we're on the next section.
All right, well, hold on 1 second. We have a follow-up to that. Luke, did you have something?
So number four and the Oregon Common Credentialing Program, should it then read a process by which boards may access the system instead of information or not?
I think that's a statutory question because I think part of that is statutory language. So let me check very quickly in the statute. Yeah, I think we have to leave it information. The purposes for which credentialing information accessed by, well, that's maybe used, so hold on 1 second. Submit signatures and contract. Okay, so accessed by, and that's why we kept access. We need that in there. If I look at, I'm looking at Senate Bill 604. I don't have the actual statute, but it's word for word. So Section 3B. Should be like 2B. Processes by which a healthcare regulatory board submits credentialing information. So it all points to information. I don't really have a problem with it saying information rather than system. Okay. Anything else on that piece? Okay, now Danielle, for real, I think you can move to the application piece. Thank you.
So just, I guess, a couple things is the big question, I guess, is do we once we go live with the system, we're not really going to have a re-credentialing application, correct?
So here's the problem with the applications. The applications are in statute saying that hospitals and health plans have to use it, and we have the OPCA and the OPRA. We will continue to allow paper applications in very, very limited circumstances. So that's the other thing I wanted to talk to you guys today, because we have to put practitioner waiver language in there, waiver from using the electronic system, in those very, very limited cases. So they technically still exist, but within the system and the new program, it won't exist for the practitioner. But it will exist on your side of the house because you have to do re-credentialing. So when you pull the file again, it would pull out all the practitioner information, and what we don't know exactly from MedPherson is how that file will look. So it will be the whole OPCA. You're probably not going to get the OPRA. So I think there's a little bit of questionable stuff in there, but essentially those paper forms will still exist. So I can't necessarily say that the OPRA will go away completely.
Okay. And then I guess if you're getting rid of number 2 and number 3, you don't need a number 1 at the beginning of the paragraph. And then the last sentence where it says, the authority-approved applications are available on the committee's website. I'm assuming you guys want that to say the authority-approved applications are available on the committee's website?
Yes, we do. Thank you.
And that's all I have.
Okay. So I want to clarify what we did here. The credentialing organizations have to use the forms, but it's really the health plans and the hospitals that are required to use those forms. But now credentialing organizations are required to use the system, and we already lay that out in these rules for credentialing organization participation. So there's no reason to have this piece once the system is implemented, number 2. So that's why we took that out. And then, so the program will use the applications for the system, and we wanted to make that clear. So we took out number 3 as well and just plugged that into the first part. So just kind of cleaning up that language. Does that make sense? Yes, Rebecca.
Yeah, thanks. I'm so kind of new to all of this, but is there a penalty, or how do you ensure compliance that hospitals and health plans are using the system once it goes live? Like, what's the...
So Rebecca from the Hospital Association is asking, is there any teeth in this, in the legislation and the rules in terms of, like, are there any penalties for noncompliance? At this point, what happened when they went forward with this legislation, they also had legislation that had to do with civil monetary penalties for not participating. And what we decided is we would use the carrot approach first and not worry about that until we need to.
Okay.
Now, in Washington, I will say that they did not have a mandate. Right. And so they had minimal participation, and it basically rendered the system useless for most folks, because if not all your practitioners are in, it's not useful. If not all your credentialing organizations are in, it's not useful for you as a practitioner. But what I would say is we've done a lot of work to foster support, and we're going to be attacking this from two different ways. It's a push-pull relationship. So practitioners will be saying, my information is in here, and you're required to get it from there. And, you know, credentialing organizations, the same thing is, you know, can we make agreements to have you have your organization push your practitioners to the credentialing system. So at the end of the day, the law is the law, and I abide to the laws, right? And I don't necessarily worry about penalties, because I know I have to follow the laws, is what we do, right? So there is that issue, though, is because we have fees associated with this, and you know how people love to pay fees. And so,
yeah, that's helpful. I haven't heard the Washington example. And so however, this, as it gets implemented, we can help with that.
Right. And I think, you know, that's why it's really important that we had the stakeholder input that we have from day one, because we built this for the stakeholders, and the stakeholders helped build all of the requirements and what we would need for this program. So, and it makes good business sense, and I think that folks really do feel that. And so we're hoping to not have an issue with that. Mm-hmm. Luke?
Listen, just for the good of the order, not to backtrack, but in the Oregon Common Credentialing Program, section 0030, number 4, the actual statute language for the HCRBs is the authority, the recommendations must specify processes by which a healthcare practitioner or healthcare regulatory board submits credentialing information to the authority. So it's just the word submit was used in statute.
Right. And then you read further in F, the purposes for which credentialing information is accessed by credentialing organizations or healthcare regulatory boards. So then that's where the term access comes in. So it captures both of those concepts. Okay, thank you. Okay, so shall we move on from credentialing application? Okay, for regulatory board participation, none of that has really changed except for the system issues and the date component. We will be still working on those dates, so we're not going to do much in looking at that because they are arbitrary.
Okay, because we're not going to be ready July 1 to send things. I think the last...
Oh, yeah, it says July 1, 17.
Yeah, the agreement that we had looked at several months ago, and we haven't heard anything back about that, so we need to have that in place before we can...
Right, and I actually did talk to Kathleen last week. And anyway, so I let her know that hopefully in the next month we'll have the format in which the vendor would prefer the information, and then we can go back to you guys and work out the details. But we'd like to have the information within the next 6 months, so probably 6 month time frame.
Okay.
Credentialing organization participation, same type of changes there, but we do have the added piece about health systems. We still are waiting for legal opinion and conversations with the health systems. I think, you know, we've stuck with, we wrote in a definition about health systems being... It's actually in the definitions that a health system is basically an organization that delivers health care and all its financially owned organizational components to that, which could include clinics and medical groups. And I think we're sticking to that definition. We have to figure out how to define financially owned, though. I think affiliations is a question that we have, and we're working with the hospital association and the health systems on that. So more to come there. Okay, and then moving to healthcare practitioner participation. The bolded areas are the areas in which we made updates from our last conversation. So I wanted to point those out. We can go over the initial changes, though, here. Healthcare practitioners required to be credentialed by a credentialing organization shall submit credentialing information and documentation required. And then if you move further into that, to the extent that correct or current information and documentation is not available in the system from the boards, healthcare practitioners, and then moving forward, healthcare practitioners may agree to submit credentialing information and documentation required prior to the start date. And so that's, you know, allowing them to come in early adoption period. So I think the only question on that is the correct or current piece. So providing documentation to the extent that the correct or current information and documentation is not available from the regulatory board. So to the extent that it's not pre-populated and correct. Any questions on that piece? No? Okay. So here's where it got a little sticky last time. Number two, healthcare practitioners must attest to all credentialing information in the system. We had issues with, is it all credentialing information that is in the system? So it could be what they provided plus verifications plus whatever. And we wanted to make sure that this is a practitioner requirement. So it's basically all information that they submit themselves. So to clarify that, this is how it went down. If folks have comments or suggestions about it, please speak up. So healthcare practitioners must update their credentialing information when changes occur and attest to the accuracy of all credentialing information and documentation submitted by the healthcare practitioner or their designee. Is that clear?
Melissa, this is Danielle. I know sure. I had brought something up about this last time, and I didn't like the language.
Okay, good. And I think, Mark, you had that point as well, so...
I did. It's hard to attest to something that you don't have any control over.
So it's their submittal.
But
is that clear enough?
The question I have now is when it says when changes occur, so is that a time, does that create a timing issue?
So the question is when changes occur, does that, when it says changes occur, does that create a timing issue? So practitioners today, I'm trying to think of how to frame this and the reason why that's put in there. Practitioners today, when changes occur, they have to notify. And there's probably, yeah, so I don't know if there is, credentialing organizations, please pipe up. But I don't know if you guys have time limitations on, you know, like when you get your, you have an address change, you have to notify the DMV within such as, I don't even know when it is, and I probably didn't do it properly last time. But,
well, for example, the medical board, you change your address, it's 30 days.
Okay, 30 days for medical board. Anybody have any time parameters on changes?
We don't. We're just happy when we get them.
And who was that on the phone?
Sorry, it's the Martel. My only concern is sometimes, though we know our provider is leaving or has left, we don't notify health plans right away because occasionally they don't necessarily, somebody who's doing the data entry doesn't always make mention of the last date, and we're still billing previous charges. So we like to have as much of that clear first. If we could rely on the fact that, yes, they left by January 31st and they're not going to just deny all of our claims flat out, even if they're for days of service before then, that's been an issue in the past. I don't know how much of that it is anymore.
So then how long is kind of your longest stint to not, don't tell anybody where you work. But is your longest stint for dragging that out? And is,
you know,
it like 30 day
thing? A lot of times it depends on the payer. And so I would say probably 2 to 3 months.
Hey, Melissa, mm-hmm. It's Anne.
Sure.
One of the things we have to remember too is the patient. I realize billing is important too. But if it's a Medicare patient and a provider's terming from a location, we have to notify that member within 30 days.
Okay.
that's actually
a good point.
On the health plan side of it, Medicare is keeping us pretty up on top of our directory. They're requiring that we actually do like regular outreach and make sure that we're trying to make sure that all of the directory
right.
information is accurate at the time that it's in the directory. So,
right, so 3 months ago.
Right. So, but you know, hopefully maybe this provider directory will help with that. But generally,
right. But if this is the authoritative source for that provider directory data, then we would want to clear some of that up here.
Sure, moved pretty quickly because the provider is contacting for like billing and stuff. Like, oh, we want to get right after so we get paid. So I just get looped into that system. So if I get notified, when billing gets notified.
Yeah, that's probably the way that happens as well.
I'm trying to think of like how practitioner billing, like what their lag in as the billing. So if the treatment occurs in January and they leave the practitioner leaves January 31st, does it take 2 to 3 months in order to bill for those services for January?
And this is me going back to my time in the claims like side of things. So from my memory, they have a year technically to submit a claim. And so the way our system's built, which I don't know if anybody else is built this way, is when we have a practitioner and they're, say, working for Providence and they leave effective February 1st, we will terminate that relationship effective February 1st, but any date of service before that is fine. It'll be processed. So even if they submit a claim a year later, that date of service is still going to hit that tax IT number and have active networks on that date. And then, you know, if they move to, say, the Corvallis Clinic after that, you know, effective February 2nd, everything going forward will be under the Corvallis Clinic. So, in
and that
our
makes
system,
sense. There should be a way to.
Yeah.
I wonder who those organizations are that aren't doing. I'm just kidding. But I wonder if they're few and far between then.
Number 3 says they'll reattest every 120 days.
Right.
So at that time, then they have to update any, when they retest, update any information.
Anyway.
I would think that would be a natural time, and then, that's when they, if it was 120-day limit, they need to update information.
So the way this is written, without a date on changes, it just implies that you should make changes when they occur, right? But it doesn't tell you exactly when, but you do have the 120-day to make sure of. So maybe it's appropriate to leave that a little open.
And that's what happened for Regis. I believe in our contracts, which is outside of the credentialing piece, we define when they have to notify us of changes. So I wonder if that could reference, because really I think provider contracts define that, at least with Regis. What we define what timely is and how, when they need to notify us of changes.
Right, but they have multiple credentialing organizations, so it would be the soonest as your most stringent standard on blah, blah, blah for your credentialing organizations. Okay, you know what? I'm going to take this one back, and I'm going to think about what we would want to do there, because, again, it does impact the provider directory as well. Okay. Is everybody okay with that, taking that back? Okay. Anybody have extreme heartburn over leaving it open-ended, though? Not really. Speak now.
Or monitor, no monetary penalty.
Right. Then when there is, then we'll have that conversation. Okay.
I had a question about the rule that, so in Section 1, it says that practitioners may submit information and documentation required pursuant to OAR number 40.
Mm-hmm.
And number 40 is about primary source verification. And so if it's coming from the practitioner, it's not primary source. And then Rule 40 also says that boards must provide information pursuant to Rule 55, which is about practitioners. And so I'm just having some trouble.
Okay. So I think, let me go to, so the primary source verification is, text, it's 40. It's backwards. So where are we
page
at?
Page 4, top of page 4.
Okay, thank you. And that's method. Yeah, so, yeah, that's not helpful. So let me explain the intent of that. The intent of that is to say you have this credentialing information, but what is the credentialing information? So I think that's why I pointed back to primary source verification, but the way that that's written is not helpful. It's just accepting the board's verification static primary source verification and methods of how we do primary source verification as a program. So I think it is not very helpful, but I'm not sure how to rectify that problem.
Could you just strike in both of the rules as provided in or pursuant to, and then the other rule number, because they seem to be talking about two different things.
So, to submit credentialing and information and document, okay, so take out required pursuant to OAR,
right,
and then it just goes documentation to the system.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the same thing in the other rule.
So, I have it up here above, too. Okay, so then we're back into regulatory board. Is that what you're saying? Where is the pointing to the 50?
Yes. To 55. At the top of page 4, where it says, the program shall accept board verification of credentialing information as provided in accordance with 55. But that's...
Okay.
They're not coming from 55.
Right. So... can we point that to 45 then? Information is provided in accordance.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, as we say, shall supplement those verifications to ensure compliance with accrediting entity standards. That covers anything that's not static or not timely.
Right.
Okay. Okay, thank you. It's been so long since I've done stuff with rules and regulations, it's always when you go back and it's a reference to this, a reference to that, and then you go in there and there's a reference to something else, and just that trail is always just the fun part of legally. Okay. Anything else then on the practitioner participation on that one piece? So one items 1 through 3. I did add in number 2, healthcare practitioners may assign a designee to submit credentialing information and documentation to the system. We did not have that piece in there before, so we have this idea of the designee, but we didn't specifically allow it in rule, and it is allowed in statute, so we're just kind of clarifying that.
Melissa,
it's
Danielle. Yes. With the addition of 2, then it looks like all your numbers after that will need to be...
Yeah, I saw that too.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
But you'll still require the practitioner to do the attestation?
Attestation, yeah. So that's why we left it at submit credentialing information and documentation, and then the attestation below points specifically to the practitioner.
And for assigning a designee, do they have to tell the system or the program who that designee is?
Yes. So I always forget which way it works. There's one way that they have it in the system, and I think it's the practitioner has to do their profile and then the designee request. The designee has to do their own profile and then the designee request, but the practitioner has to say yes.
Okay.
So I have to clarify that one, and I'll be doing that in the next few days.
I think that's similar to how the PDMC works.
Yes, better than it used to be, because you need to know the
Yeah, we would not need a notary. No.
Just so long as you know that there will probably be some who just have someone log into their system.
We are aware of that. So practitioners have a problem with the program in the sense that they will have to physically touch it. Right now, a piece of paper slips under their nose several times a year to sign, and that's a little bit different than actually having to go in and use your own username and password. We have user agreements saying, thou shall not share, but we realize that that may occur. But we just would not be really aware of that. Yeah. Okay. So I made some clarifying language in here in number 4 from the last time we spoke. Healthcare practitioners credentialed by one or fewer credentialing organizations, we basically put that to by only one credentialing organization. So because if you're not being credentialed, so if your credential is fewer, you shouldn't even be in the system. So we just took that out and put by only one credentialing organization. Then we made consistency changes. So the third line there, so but must update their credentialing information when changes occur and attest to the accuracy of all credentialing information and documentation submitted by the healthcare practitioner or their designee. Any comments on that? Okay. So moving on to number 5, I wanted to talk about how practitioners may request a waiver from electronic submission. And what we've plugged in here is it's similar language to how we have the boards requesting a hardship waiver from submitting information, and a little bit similar to the prepaid group practice exclusion language. But essentially, we landed on hardware or service constraints or physical impairments, but we do not define those things in this example. So I'll read this for folks, and then we can talk about it. I have some examples for what we can put in order to define it, but I don't know how much we want to define. Practitioners may petition the authority. So the authority has control over who gets approved for this waiver. For consideration of a waiver from the electronic submission of credentialing information and documentation required in this rule, to the extent that a hardware or service constraint or physical impairment exists. So for that, I have some questions for you in terms of do I need to write anything in about severity to the extent that a severe hardware service constraint, or and then you get into maybe having to define severe, and so I just kind of want your thoughts on this language.
I think it might be helpful for the sake of clarifying between a practitioner who doesn't like to use a computer as opposed to a practitioner who cannot use a computer.
I agree with you. Because they still can, like, request a waiver and get it denied, correct?
Right.
So let's just say that in that circumstance, which we all have practitioners on computers,
right.
And they get denied, they have to follow the process. So I almost think less is more, but that's my personal opinion, because when you start narrowing it, then you're going to get exceptions to that process. And I do believe you're going to get folks that are going to request a waiver. So defining
it. But we do want to limit that, too.
Sure. But you also have the authority to deny that waiver, right?
Right.
So that would probably cover, and Deb, you may be able to speak to this, but the possibility that a practitioner says, oh, I already have this completed OPCA, let me just spec it and request this waiver, if you would not, you know, want to give them hardship waiver if they're not deserving.
I'm thinking more like a solo practitioner.
Yes. One moment.
And it's their career. Not necessarily the point of retirement,
mm-hmm.
But has not adopted technology.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're still there. They're not part of the group.
Yeah.
We have them, and we have that difficulty on the medical staff side.
Right.
Physically have to go and fulfill their application, or they have to come in. They're not going to, they won't give us an email address.
We're talking about those practitioners that are close to retirement that are still fighting the computer.
Is there any, and I'm not shouting for folks in the room, I'm shouting across the room to the phone. Is there any information on, is this 5%, 2%, 1%?
We have no idea.
1%, but I look for the credentialing organizations for that.
We do no longer offer paper applications and renewals for licensees, but we have open office hours, and we get people who come in and sit down with a staff member and go through their renewal every year. Mm-hmm. So it's not a huge number of people, but it exists.
But so that's a more difficult process because you have to physically go down there. So you might have minimal numbers because of that, and maybe we want to think about that rather than a waiver.
Not if you're in John Day.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Somewhere else, which is probably where.
But you could go to your local credentialing organization.
There's a rare number, but they're out there. So we make exceptions to the rules and trying to support them. So, I mean, if you're thinking about that loan provider, as you said, in John Day or Ontario, they're there.
Right. Danielle, what did you have in mind, on your mind?
There's a couple people that, at least for me, it was very hard to hear them, so I don't know if I got all of the conversations. So
yeah,
if I can, I apologize. I guess if people are saying that they might have a hardware or service, you know, like a constraint, I don't know if they're necessarily going to have an email address for you. So I don't know if the phone number and email address, what if they don't have an email address? Like the people who are closer to retirement who are not wanting to do, I mean, I know it's weird to say, but I have providers who refuse to acknowledge that they have an email address because they don't want communication that way.
Okay, I noted that. I don't know how I want to handle that just yet. Okay. Is there, what I think, though, is that bothers me is physical impairment to me is, I think that can be very clear. I mean, there's tons of different ways you can categorize physical impairment. But to me, when we talk about hardware or service constraints, that could mean a whole slew of things, and that could open the door to a lot of waivers. Like, I don't know, maybe my computer sucks, and you know, I don't have the right buttons on my my keyboard because my dog chewed them off. I don't know. there could be a number of different things. Like, is there a way we can or should at least put some type of adjective or narrow this in front of that? So I'm going to point to this lovely email from our technical expert in language that he threw out there. Find the right email. So he classified hardware and service constraints, which is, you know, just a starting point. I'm not really sure that this would apply a lot at all, but some of it does. So hardware and service constraints. A practitioner does not have the ability to access 1.5 megabits or faster internet connection speeds due to either lack of carrier coverage at practice location or cost to access service being excessive. And I can understand that. But then he further describes excessive as more than $3,000 per year in cost and maintenance. Well, a lot of credentialing organizations, if you know, a larger organization would end up paying that. So I think that's excessive is a hard thing to define. I think that I think we can make some changes there, but then if you allow that, you'd have to allow or require that your exclusion request includes the service address location for verification purposes. And then the other requirement under here is practitioners unable to access site and or maintain a connection for periods of 4 or more hours between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m., 15 or more days in a given month due to service outages from practitioners, internet service provider due to outage of the common credentialing program site. I think that's pretty specific. Is it too specific?
I have a few questions.
Okay.
One is, will the program, the system, be compatible with mobile devices? Because we have more and more, we can do Google Analytics and find out what kind of a device they're accessing, and we're seeing more and more people who are doing it from their cell phone, so then it might not require internet connectivity because they're using cell. But having mobile compatibility is another factor for a software system or web application. So is the system going to be mobile compatible? And then totally different question is, who's reviewing the waivers? Do you have somebody who's going to be approving and denying these? And then suggestion would be, what if you didn't get to this level of detail, but you just said, may petition the authority for consideration of a waiver pursuant to the authority-approved form, and then you just have a form that has checkboxes, like, I don't have internet connectivity, I can't afford internet, and then you could put that level of detail on a form that they can just select one of them and then write an explanation detailing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's an option. Nicole just assigned us some more work.
Yeah, well, I think, again, to follow up, and I think what Nicole's driving at, and don't let me put words in your mouth, but I think this is about, you know, facilitating the process and allowing some flexibility for those that truly are unable to do this electronically. And so I don't think you're really going to know until you get some experience with this as to what level of detail you might need. So I think giving yourself some flexibility as an agency would be helpful too, as long as there is the process to apply for a waiver. And I think, you know, again, the devil's in the details, but you don't really know what kind of details you're going to need.
And even when you find out what the number to set the bandwidth at or the cost, that's something that will change annually.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just sitting here right now, and no internet access, and my hotspot has got one bar because we're in the middle of this building. So, I mean, you know, it depends on the circumstance. So.
Right. So if you're in a meeting for 4 or more hours a day, you're out. If you're seeing patients for 4 or more. Okay. All right. I think I have, I wanted to ask one question. So mobile availability, I know that's something that we talked about when we built requirements, and I know we wanted to make sure that it was compatible for certain devices and stuff like the iPads and whatnot, and I'm pretty sure we wrote requirements in there about mobile availability, but I can't remember exactly. I wanted to ask Hillary if she knew about MedVersant currently with mobile.
From
not
my
that
understanding,
it worked well.
With our program, it's not there.
Okay.
It's just on, and it's limited to PC and then Mac users if they're not using whatever. Yes.
Okay.
So, and I don't know how that would differ between, you know, Microsoft versus Google-based.
Right.
Android versus iPhone.
And I believe we put Safari in there for requirements,
okay,
though, too.
So, and that, I know you guys have done a lot more work with the IT side than we ever thought to do. So, so that may negate a lot of the issues that we've seen with the availability.
I'll clarify that too.
A percentage
but
of people who are doing their license application,
sure,
and renewal from their mobile device.
I would want to.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Sure.
Okay.
It's a pretty complicated process, though. So you
yeah.
I mean, I
you
guess
have to, there's so many fields. That would be a lot to do on a phone.
Right.
But
you're
like,
a tablet.
Yeah.
Maybe attestation, but.
Yeah.
Right.
But you're thinking about physicians, right? I mean,
right,
so
physicians.
Yeah,
well,
a little bit
you
of
know
that.
What I mean? Have a little downtime meeting with the phone. I mean,
yeah,
that's the reality of where we are today.
I was just thinking, like, for me looking at an application and making sure I'm looking at it on a tablet would be, like, the smallest it would go for something with that much information. But, you know, maybe there's
right.
better.
Mm-hmm.
They
fill out
medical
records. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Every
day. So, they're filling out medical records from their phone.
The thing that we're hearing now is that they're, when they get to their completion page and it says, please print this page for their records, they can't do that because they're on a mobile device. So, and that's one of our number one complaints is, I did the whole thing on my mobile device and then you told me to print and I can't print. So,
can you like print the PDF and just save it to your device?
You can, or you could take screenshots. But, I mean, they are, so we're hearing from them that they're using it. We can see on Google Analytics that I think, the last I checked, I think it was like 20% of people are using their mobile device to do their application and renewal.
So that would probably cut down on the amount of waivers you guys have requested if that's something that they're able to do.
Okay. We're not going to solve this problem today. But I have noted everyone's comments, and I think we'll take that back internally and have fun with it and come back. Okay, anything else on that piece? All right, what time are we at? We are at 11. We are doing good. Okay, so use of healthcare practitioner information. I'm still working on this piece. There are concerns, of course, of ownership of data. Mark, you pointed this out as well. Medical Board has pointed this out in the past. You know, what are we going to do with the data? Our only intention is to share the directory-related data with the statewide provider directory. And, you know, that I think we can clearly spell out for folks. I don't think we would clearly spell that out in rule. For the directory, it would, you know, basically be name, practice locations, specialties, and affiliations. And so all of that would be pushed to the provider directory. And then from there, that data is validated with a number of other components. And there's a, like, patient accepting new patients and practice hours and other components, and that would be part of a full complete record for the provider directory. So that's what we intend to do with this data, sharing only the directory related data. Statute says that none of this information can be publicly disclosed except for the directory related. But what we have the opportunity to do as an agency is define the directory. And I think we're still waiting on some DOJ, Department of Justice clarification as to how we can limit it to our provider directory. But where it goes from there, that directory-related data is shared with other organizations through the statewide provider directory. I would say that that's not meant to be an external facing system. So for patients to go on and be like, I need a provider in this area that speaks this language and office hours, yada, yada. It is for the validation of other provider directories, so credentialing organizations, well, we wouldn't call them that on the provider directory side. They would be like hospitals, health plans, whatever, could come in and pull the directory-related data for their practitioners and use it for their directory validation. Or it can be used for analytical purposes, like OHSU wants to do a study on different provider detail and workforce stuff, and so they would use it for that. So it would be externally used from there, but not patient-facing. So we're gonna do a little more work with our Department of Justice on how we can limit the data sharing to a specific directory. Other than that, I mean, it's open in statute if we can't get that limited through the DOJ opinion, but I just wanted to let you know that we're working on that piece and see if you guys had any other comments, especially medical board and OMA.
So I'm understanding this correctly. In 60, paragraph 3, when it talks about except for general information used for directories, the intention is to just point that to for the statewide provider directory only.
Right.
Are there other directories, plural, out there that OHA is contemplating?
Well, I think the initial DOJ opinion we got is it basically said we should define directories. And we have the ability to define it, and we may be able to narrow that just to the statewide provider directory. But, you know, public disclosure is, so it's more of like what that information is that's directory related. Because if we have a public disclosure request, then we would have to relinquish that directory data. But so we have to kind of clearly define what that data is and what the directory could be. So anyway, there's
more work yet to come on this.
On that piece, yeah. I just made number 4 up.
Okay.
I'm not a lawyer. And so I do still need that opinion and help in writing that piece. And so we're doing that work in terms of having them understand what our business needs are, what our intention of sharing is, what we don't want to happen with folks' data. So all of those pieces are under consideration and just trying to get that opinion as to what to do there.
And then, so all of the information that's going into the program is public record?
No.
Well, it's all public record. I mean, you can
could find most of it. Not there are other pieces like the attestation page, like felony or disability.
But once it's done by the state, it's a public record.
Not according to the statute protects all the data except for directory
related. It's protected, but it's still public record. So public record, and then you exempt certain public records from disclosure.
Okay.
And then you can redact information that's within other records, but they're all still considered public records. That some are excluded and some are redacted. Under, I mean, once it's owned by the state for a state business. And so if you are sharing it, then we can only charge by public records fees. So is the information something that OHA would be selling or releasing as a public record?
We will certainly be selling it to the provider directories as we want some money for the use of that directory-related data, and that helps lower our costs. If we do have to give it to folks, we will charge for it. I don't think we wouldn't. And I think it would probably, we'd probably look to other systems like APAC and how they kind of determine their costs for pulling data and whatnot. But we have it to find that internally.
Okay. Because all of the information that we give to the program, for someone to request that data from us, is $75. Because it's a public
good
record.
To know.
So to then see it be taken by the program as sold at something that I assume would be higher than $75 is, you know,
do you want to cut?
Well, no, it's just that, you know, we can't sell it.
Right.
So how
right.
is the program able yeah. to take our data and then sell it?
Yeah.
How are you defining the ownership of that data? Does that just mean it's in our system, it's just stored in our system?
The question is, how are we defining ownership?
Well, and that's I think that's the question, is it our own data? So then if you're selling it, are we getting that money because we're the owners of it? And do we consent to that sale? Or, you know, how does that work? Because we're only allowed to charge public records fees for that data. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Making notes. So the way I see this is we do not intend to sell this data. And we want to protect whatever data is in that system, except for giving directory-related data to the provider directory. And then there is a question of how does ownership work? Because if you provide us data as the medical board and we pre-populate the application, then once the practitioner touches that and starts changing things, the practitioner owns that data. And is it still an ownership relationship between the medical board and the system, or is it now fully the practitioner and the system? So I think there's some questions to be worked through there. In terms of turning it around and getting money from the provider directory, we're getting a certain amount of money overall for the system capability to pull that data, and then and you know, the actual data. So we've pegged that at a certain amount, and there's a lot of analysis that went into that as well. I think that we can bring this conversation between the state and the medical board, but I would really say that we don't intend to sell that data, and we don't intend to have a bunch of public records requests, and that's why we're doing a lot of work to limit the ability for people to
keep
public records.
So you said getting $75 for each person that you give them initial data on?
No.
They're our friends.
I mean, I'm just meaning legally.
No.
Not necessarily as a friendship. But
right,
that's,
no.
Yeah, because disclosing that, mm-hmm. even to your members, then is a little questionable.
So from a user perspective, at least on the credentialing organization side,
mm-hmm.
when we pay the yearly fee to use the database, is
mm-hmm.
that including the directory, or is the directory an additional cost to us?
No, the directory is not an additional cost
okay.
to you. The directory helps lower the cost
okay.
to you, actually.
And then is the timeline for the directory kind of the same as the timeline for the whole system, or do we know yet?
It comes probably about 3 months afterwards,
okay.
3 to 6 months afterwards. So it's trailing behind, and they're somewhat in the stage that we're in, except they have CMS reviews on all of their contracting components. Right.
So, I apologize. I heard that you say you do not intend to sell the data. I've
uh-huh.
also heard you say you will absolutely sell the data to lower the cost. And so
to the provider directory.
So
the provider
the
directory
provider
is
directory?
Our only intention. It's OHA.
So
it's OHA's statewide provider directory.
So OHA would pay who for
So the we would recoup money from the provider directory pots of funding to common credentialing for the use of that data to feed the directory. So, but we don't intend to sell that data outside of. And so what we're concerned with is what kind of public requests, public disclosure requests we would have from this law. So the statute limits it to just the directory-related data. But directory-related, so it's general information used for directories. So we have the ability to define general information and directories. And so that's what we're trying to make sure is somewhat narrow, because we don't want to be sharing the data willy-nilly. So that's the intention there. I think, you know, the statute is mandating that the healthcare regulatory boards provide this data to the state. There is no money that's tied to that statutory language. And it's not necessarily a public records request either. So I think there's that to consider. I'm thinking about, with healthcare regulatory boards, what we've said to them, though, is that we would make them whole for providing it. So whatever the cost is to code the flat file exchange and meetings that you have to have, then we would be able to pay that piece of it. So certainly that. But I think there is a conversation to be had in terms of what if there are other requests for that data, and where does ownership transfer, how much ownership transfers. I think there's some fun questions in that. So we'll keep that on our radar. As we go through our data use agreement, I think when we come back to you guys about the details in that, I think we'll peg that for that conversation. And we'll try to have that one with you first so we relay the same information to the other boards. Okay. Okay. Any other questions on that? So the advisory group, we just made some clarifying changes. A lot of our stuff in the past had said appointed by the director, approved by the director. We're trying to do director, director's designee, or the authority. And then that way it's administrative simplification for us, because it is very hard to get the director's decision and signature on everything. Then we have until 12, right? Yeah. Okay. Then we have under number 5B, we wanted to clarify that common credentialing solution means the common credentialing system and functionality. So it's basically the system functionality that we are getting advisement on, which would include primary source verification in those pieces. I'm wondering, though, if it makes sense to pull out here that's the Oregon Common Credentialing Program, because there are other programmatic pieces outside of the system functionality. So for those of you that have participated on our SME group, let me know how that feels to you. Any thoughts? Because I might change that to say the Oregon Common Credentialing Program. But it is actually, let's see, now that I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, so it says the advisory group shall advise the authority on the OCCP, so that covers the program, and then including the system functionality. So I think that actually clears it up. This is a working meeting. Okay. Okay. Any questions on that piece? Okay. Imposition of fees, that is still underway in terms of how we're going to point to the fee structure. Need some opinion on that. We don't charge a lot of fees under OHA except for in public health, so we're trying to get some examples from them. For healthcare practitioners, there was a question about paying ongoing, I'm thinking. What we've pointed out in here is that under number two, healthcare practitioners shall pay a one-time application fee to the authority at initial application submittal in accordance to the fee structure available, yada, yada. Not pay an annual ongoing fee. Was there any unclarity around that?
So what you just read said that it'll be paid upon the application submittal, but isn't it actually registration?
There is a question about that, so that may actually change. I think that we, in some conversations, we have said at submittal. So you fill out all your stuff. So it's like TurboTax in that sense is what some of that thinking was. You fill out all the information, but until you submit, you don't have to pay because you're not technically doing anything with that. But then we have this idea that enrollment, you would put your information in, which would include your payment information and that type of thing. So I think we're still working out the details of that fiscal services component. So the question here is there's no reference to a healthcare practitioner being held harmless from bearing a portion or all of the credentialing organization fees. So does it seem like there's some ambiguity here that there would be some kind of risk of practitioners having to bear some of the credentialing organization fees at all?
Hey, Melissa, this is Jess Bertel.
Uh-huh.
What's to stop an insurance company from turning around and charging us now to be on their panel if it costs them to get our information from this?
Okay. So that might be a little bit of what that comment entails, like the passing on of fees. And that is a risk, and I'm not sure how we necessarily stop that. I think I would need a DOJ opinion as to what parameters we can put into place to limit that occurrence. Because I know that folks have said if this cost go up, there may be that practice going on. Like a CBO, for example, may pass on any additional charges or whatnot. And I think that we need to pay real close attention to how much this is really costing us in our system. For most of the, for the most part, looking at market research and how much it's costing to do credentialing verifications and collecting of that information, it's disparate. There are some organizations charging $150. We've even seen $250, and we've also seen much lower costs in the $30 to $40 range. So I think that there is some questionability as to what this is really going to cost organizations. I think as we've worked through conversations and the impact analyses of looking at what the fees would do to folks' budget, going line by line through what services are we providing, what can you use out of our system, then folks are like, oh, okay, so I can probably cut out this piece. I can probably cut out that. Like if you're looking at the AMA profiles or something, I'm no longer going to have to do that. I'm no longer going to have this piece. But you would still have other components, and there are workflow considerations, at least in the first year, trying to incorporate this into your process. Like, you're going to have to spend time looking at your credentialing policies and altering those. You're going to have to spend some time doing some double checking to make sure that you're comfortable with what you're getting from the system, right?
Yeah, I think that's the thing. There's not really going to be any cost savings, particularly upfront, because we have to be able to continue doing two processes and maybe forever, depending on.
So that's a concern. We don't think that that's forever. We think that's a temporary thing. Except when you get to getting the information out of our system into your system. So that's going to be key, because in the beginning, if you don't have an API set up into your system, then you're basically needing to extract the information from our system and then upload it into yours. So then that's an additional piece. You should not have to redo verifications, but you may have credentialing policies that are more stringent than accrediting entity standards. So if you have, so like some organizations, I think Danielle can speak to this too, because she'll have some of this issue that, you know, work history has to be less than 90 days old taking it to committee. And that's not necessarily true for accrediting entity standards. So they may be doing extra verifications where they could leverage our verifications in the system. And so there are some of those pieces where there will be overlap, and I think it's a real challenge to think about how you look at your credentialing policies today, how you look at the information, and how that aligns with what a centralized system can provide and the assurances that we would have in terms of how we're verifying information, what's acceptable to you and what's not acceptable to you. We also understand that there's some real medical liability concerns, a lot of money attached to liability in this area, so folks can be protective of that.
And we were talking about point A, about one-time application fees. So I'll share our contract with practitioners. We have to give them at least 60 days notice in their contract prior to a change in their contract, which would be like a fee, or you need to submit your application to the day. So when we're talking
sure.
about timelines and things of, you know, July 2017, you know, other organizations have different, they need to give notice, things like that. And prior to that, has to go to certain committees to get approved internally prior to changing a contract. So it's kind of thinking about that.
On the hospital
side, interesting to know.
Fee concept is an issue for us.
Mm-hmm.
Our application fee does more than support. First of all, it really doesn't support the prevention. It really supports the medical staff leadership.
Right.
And from a physician perspective, I can see the physician saying, I'm no longer going to pay your fee to join your hospital. And again, we use it for leadership development and to pay our leaders to support our hospital, not training for the credentialing process. So now I either have to change what I call it. So it's no longer going to be an application fee. It's going to be a membership fee to join our organization. And again,
it's a privileging, right?
We charge it whether you have privileges or not.
Okay.
It's to support the medical staff organization. It's an independent organization and they're self-sustaining. I have small hospitals.
Uh-huh.
They don't make a lot of money, and these physicians spend a lot of time on physician issues. So that $150 that they're paying now, it, again, doesn't support my staff as a medical staff to do the credentialing. It supports really our leaders, their leadership in the medical staff organization to support them as a medical staff organization. And I think it's a concern because if I was a physician and now I have to pay $150 to participate in a statewide initiative and the hospitals are still charging application fees or membership fees, it's now added to the bottom line of a physician.
Right. And it is an added. And overall, though, they are, I mean, there's a clear value for the centralized system. We stayed away from, though, the practitioner ongoing fee because of that, because the credentialing piece is buried in different costs. And so, yes, it is a fee to them that's in addition, but it's one time, and it should minimize their burden for ongoing, right? So once you're in for life. But I think it's a very good point that you may have something that's interpreted as if it's an application fee here and they consider it credentialing, you know, it's, and you can say, you know, it is part of the privileging process and it supports the medical staff and whatnot. I think that's important to know and understand in terms of incorporating this into your workflow. But there might be, I'm thinking of business change leadership and we want to do change management plans. That's something that we should consider to have as advice. Like you may want to look at how you communicate fees to practitioners.
On the other end, it means a bylaws change, so I have to do six bylaws
right.
changes.
And then that's legal possible. Interpretation, and yeah. So that's all part of it. So initially, yes, you don't anticipate any savings because of that.
From the health plan side, and this may be too soon to say, we haven't discussed it internally, but I wouldn't imagine that we would build fees into our structure as far as charging providers to be on panel.
Right.
That doesn't seem like a good way to go about it to me personally. But what I would say is if we were trying to lower the cost, we would just start delegating to a lot of our larger groups and possibly lower tier so that, you know, the overall cost is lower on our end. If that's, I mean, if that's something that we were really concerned about as far as trying to make this cost less for us. I can't imagine that we would start charging our providers. But again, we have the same policy that if we're going to make contract changes, we have to notify them 60 days as well. Mm-hmm. So that's something that, if that decision were made at the company level, then providers would at least have 2 months to notice that.
Okay. Well, I mean, in the end, the costs are going to be passed on. I mean, HealthShare, Providence, Moda didn't budget for what is now being expected anyway. So it's going to come out of rates. It's going to come out of admin. It's going to have to come from somewhere because these fees that have been published were not even incorporated into the budgets we're working on for next year mm-hmm. at that rate. So, mm-hmm. I mean, especially for the CCOs, depending on where you guys get cut in actual budget, too, I don't...
And I think there are more in the CCO contract of 2018, how that's, you know, just for communication as an organization,
So, and the interesting thing when you think about the CCOs, and I think it's the way it works for most of HealthShare, and I know it's in the EMHEL part of Jackson County, I think Care Oregon does most of the credentialing for those networks. So whether or not, well, maybe not
it's not HealthShare, but it's
but then EMHEL, I think, for sure Jackson Care, a couple of other ones.
I thought they did. So
they do.
I talked to Care Oregon. Yeah. Okay, but
yeah,
they don't do the...
We have four physical health plans and multiple dental and behavioral health, so Care Oregon's a piece of it.
But I just don't know if HealthShare is actually even credentialing or if it's Care Oregon, Providence, Kaiser, and Tuolumne.
Both. We do direct behavioral health credentialing of multiple organizations who themselves do are considered... We delegate credentialing to them. Small and large behavioral health organizations, and we have dental plans that do their own credentialing, physical health plans that do their own credentialing, Providence, Care Oregon. So.
But we would essentially then probably pay the actual fee that would count towards us too, because we're doing the main credentialing for providers that are in the CCOs or in HealthShare.
Yeah, to the extent you're making the decision. Yeah.
So maybe we'll actually pay a bunch of this.
Yes. Clarify.
Okay. So that's another piece of a question of, you know, is it clear the delegated versus full? So when we look at credentialing organizations in number one, A is pay one-time setup fee, and then B and C are how we count our practitioners on our panels. So B is identify panel size using a full count of its credentialed healthcare practitioners in which a decision to credential the practitioner is made by the credentialing organization. And then C is not include their healthcare practitioner panel size fully delegated, a fully delegated healthcare practitioners in which a decision is made by a separate credentialing organization. So is that clear as to how you count your practitioners? If you're making the decision, they're yours. If not, if you have that fully delegated relationship where somebody else is collecting, verifying, and making the decision, then it's on that person's panel, that organization's panel.
I think Kelsher has a little...
This is Patty from Regents. That makes sense, but I just wonder how that plays with the NCQA and even URAC requirements that say, even though you delegate the credentialing decision, you still, each health plan still has the final say, the final rights. You could override that. So how does that...
Well, they have the final rights and responsibility, but yeah, you are still delegating it. You're getting a roster, per se, of that practitioner's information for your directory. So you're not actually collecting and verifying and taking it to your committee. If you are taking it to your committee and making that decision, then they're on your panel.
Well, I think it's kind of the worst, because the delegate, we're required to say we still retain the final right, even though we're delegating the decision at 99.9% of the time.
Right.
You accept that decision, but there are ones where you look at and say, yeah, maybe not. So I just, that came up in our review, because we still have to have that requirement in our delegation contracts.
Okay, so then to the extent that you actually pluck one out and make a credentialing decision, then that practitioner would then be on your panel.
So they wouldn't be, because they're denying them, basically what you're saying. So
Yeah. Unless you deny
them.
Is
they
what
they're
saying.
Okay. So is there anything that's limiting the increase in fees? So just referencing, and I don't know that I've seen it in the rule a lot, where you just reference a website, establishes a max of 5% increase a year, something that gives some kind of stability for us to be able to actually manage this.
Right. So here's how the fees work in the state. Every time, if we have to increase the fees, we have to go back to the legislature, and there's a whole public process for this. And what we've tried to do in contract is limit increases to inflation and utilization.
In your contract with?
With the vendors. So in our contract with our vendors, because that's what this relies on, I think, I don't know that we can necessarily put something like that in rule. I can bring that internally and see. I just don't think we can. But, you know, we're trying to hold on to protections from that. Right now our fee schedule is an up-to amount that we're trying to get approved by the legislature. So we can charge less, but we can't charge more unless we go through the whole legislative process again. So I think that's a protection for that, too. What's that?
Just as a budget note. That's what you're talking about.
Well, it's in. They usually go through OHA's budget fee bill, their budget bill, and the fees are approved as a component of that.
So I would say that Providence would be a strong advocate for some kind of stability in what the fee structure is. I mean, not having, we have to figure out how to make it work with the fees that are larger than we originally thought they would be anyway. Mm-hmm. Some kind of consistency moving forward, but maybe, you know, replicating the percentage increase or whatever you have established for both providers and credentialing organizations would be.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
This might be clarified in previous definitions, but only counting for practitioners. I don't know if that needs to be clarified here.
Oh, it does, actually. Thank you. Definitely. Okay.
I thought that I saw you were planning to ask DOJ if you had to put the fee scheduling rule or if you could refer to a website.
We still are working that out.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and so right now we're trying to get from public health, like, what is your recommended way to do this? Because they put fees in all the time. So.
Yeah, our fees are all in a fee schedule and rule. And then any changes, we could always charge less than what's
right.
in the rule.
Right.
But any changes have to go through DAS for approval and then through the legislative process. And so I'm not sure if putting them on a website then is sort of skirting that.
No. Well, so we, well, that's a good point because we are putting them in here saying the fees are here, but then it can change on the website.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay.
And you're going to have the waiver request for the practitioners who may not have the ability to get on and do that. Are you having any sort of hardship waiver for the fees?
No.
Plans or
I think that what we've discussed internally is that we would allow some leeway within how long it takes to recoup the fees. So if we are operational April 1st, 2018, would we allow 6 months to recoup the fee from the credentialing organization? And so I think we are looking at that and so that there would be some leeway in that. I know there are some concerns.
Can I ask a question then about the fees? So the number's based on 300 credentialing organizations, and I know even internally talking to my staff, they each answered for their own organizations, and I'm hoping we counted as one organization. So I'm just a little concerned about the number of 300 being an inaccurate number. If that is the case, and we find out there's less credentialing organizations within the state, and as you kind of alluded, we may have a higher bill than anticipated. We have a budgeted. We're not quite sure what changes may come into play. How do we have some reassurances kind of that we'll know what final numbers are or have some advance notice? Because it is a huge budgetary impact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if people haven't alluded, even though it may not have an initial...
Rules Advisory Committee for Credentialing, May 23rd, 2017, Part 2. Okay. So anyhow, that's how we've built the fee structure, and so we're still working on finalizing exactly what the fees will be, and then we'll plug them in. It sounds like we need to put them into the rule to have them there, too. So that is part of the process. So any changes to the fees that are in excess of that, we do have to go back to the legislature, but we can charge less from what's in rule. I will say that we have a mandate that we provide at least 6 months' notice as to what the fees are and when the start date is. We intend to provide more than that. We hope to iron out the fee schedule in the next few months and ensure that that's put in place so folks can budget for the next year. But that may only give you 10 months to prepare for that. But if we have like a little bit of leeway in how we collect those fees from you, then you could get to the year in advance. But I would definitely look to the fee schedule now that's out there.
And
okay.
I'm kind of wondering on the fee schedule, too, if we are paying the upfront fee and what percentage of practitioners will be in the system. So if we worry that maybe there won't be 100% of practitioners, so we'll be duplicating our system but paying for the full amount.
Right. So the question is I need more water. Can we expect to have basically the majority of the practitioners in there? We expect a 90% adoption rate, and that's based on our communications with the practitioners trying to get them in. So it's part of marketing and outreach, but it's also part of you guys pushing your practitioners there. There's also continuous monitoring of sanctions and expirables in the system that we expect, and so you want all your practitioners in, even if you're not recredentialing them at the moment, because that's an important factor, especially when you're paying high fee for that. So we will have early adoption. And again, we're marketing and outreach will really push those folks in, but it might be maybe 3 to 6 months before all those folks get in.
So for the fee seekers are doing for the exclusion monitoring, if those providers are that are on the waiver, they're not going to be in the system. And I know it's probably hopefully going to be a handful. So would that be something that the credentialing organizations would be expected to kind of do on their own? So like just that, you know, dozen providers or whatever it is.
They would be in the system.
Okay, so it's not going to, they're not just missing, they're just doing it a little differently.
They would have to just do the manual process, but it would get into the system,
okay.
Whether we key it in or they go somewhere to a physical location and key it in. Like however we decide to do that, that piqued my interest a little bit, how medical board does it. But it wouldn't be on you guys.
Okay.
All right, all things fun. Okay, we'll move on to delegation agreements. I really want to talk about this a little bit. I had a slide on it. But essentially, we talked to stakeholders a lot about delegation agreements in the last few years and the importance of them. We don't want to stifle the progress that's been made with delegation agreements. They're there for a reason. They're there for efficiency purposes, and that's really what we're trying to do is be more efficient and, again, reduce those burdens on practitioners. So we don't want to eliminate the use of delegation agreements, but we do want to ensure that credentialing organizations are using the system to get the information to the extent that it's available. And to the extent that it's available in the system, there's no need to go out and get it somewhere else if you're already paying for it in the system. So the idea was delegation agreements should not be necessary if they're just for the collecting and verification of practitioner information. So that said, we also don't want to have people getting information from the system and then sharing it all over as well. So we want to have a little bit of control over that. Our DOJ opinion had said that delegation agreements were not meant to be excluded, not explicitly meant to be excluded from this process. So we need to define how delegation agreements should be used. So that said, we need to kind of clearly state that delegation agreements are not necessary for collection and verification. But I'm not sure that we totally need to state that here's all the reasons why they're necessary. But what we had looked at as stakeholders is that they should continue to exist to the extent that they create efficiencies outside the role of the OCCP, which could include roster agreements, so full delegation agreements where the credentialing decision is made. The credentialing decision will not be made at the program level, the centralized system level. So in that sense, that's outside of the role of the OCCP. So there's still a need for that. There's still a need for that quality control piece of delegation agreements as well. Go ahead, Amy.
We say shall not be used for collection. As you're describing it, maybe shall not be required? Or are you saying delegation agreements are not required for the shall make more sense to you?
Shall does because
I was looking at that too, and I was wondering if we're really saying that it shouldn't solely be used for that, because we would still delegate this, and then our delegates use the system program for that. So we're still delegating it to them who have agreements to use the process. So I wonder if we're just saying technically we can't use CBOs anymore. That's who you would delegate to.
Right, but you can use CBOs for other pieces. So so I'm thinking that for privileging and stuff, that's still part of some CBOs processes, right? So you would actually need it for some verification. It's kind of, delegation agreements is one of my least favorite subjects, apart from fees. But in this process.
Well, I think it brings up the flip side of what we talked about is, earlier, health plans or others potentially putting costs for application fees. But I know one of the conversations we've had is also then would our delegation agreements, would the delegates then assume or expect cost if we delegate to them because then they're picking up the cost?
Right. So then if we have, because we have the language at the end that basically says delegation agreements between credentialing organizations shall not solely be used for the collection and verification of credentialing information to the extent that it is available in the OCCP system, then that would then still allow for that privileging.
There's more to delegation. I think it's a mutually beneficial arrangement for a number of reasons. It's not just for privileging, and it's not just for verification
components.
Right. I don't want to undersimplify the benefit of delegation because delegated organizations get a benefit from the health plans as well as the health plans by the delegatee. I think the concern we have is that we've heard delegation goes away with this, and really it doesn't.
No.
Primary source verification may go away. The collection of information is housed in a central repository, so those needs are no longer needed by organizations. But that doesn't preclude delegation in any capacity, and that's something we just want to make sure is clear in whatever law or statement is out there.
Well, I guess the only delegation that's going away is that, like, partial delegation where you're having the delegate collect all the information for you and then bring it to you for a decision, because that's essentially pointless at this stage. So, I mean, as long as I don't know that we have any delegates like that. We've always delegated the whole thing. So, you know, you're collecting all the information, you're verifying it, you're making the decision, and that's within our delegation agreement. And so for those, it doesn't seem to be affected by this. It just might require some changes to that agreement and how the information is collected, but not necessarily that we can't do that. I mean, I would almost say that it would increase the amount of delegations out there, just because I know, like, for instance, you know, for delegating to SAM or, you know, Legacy or whatever, they're already credentialing their practitioners, so they're already, you know, accruing that cost. It's not really increasing their cost at all. So, you know, it just makes more sense for us to kind of hand that over to them and get a delegation agreement to reduce the cost on our piece of it. But, you know, for those smaller groups, obviously, that aren't necessarily credentialing their practitioners to the same level as, like, a hospital would,
mm-hmm.
that's not going to make sense for them to do.
Okay. So thinking about it from the CBO perspective, so thinking about what both of you have said, but also thinking about it, thank you, Nicole, from the CBO perspective, I'm thinking about the COIPA example where they collect and verify, but they also do the privilege verification and those pieces. So I know that some of the organizations they work with would still want to delegate that whole thing to them. If they don't want to bother with it, just use the same system. You can be signed up as a user under our profile. I think that's the way I'm imagining it. They would just give Jen Wait a sub-account. Right, and so she could pull it from their system to her system or whatever. And I wish Jen was on the phone, but she wasn't able to be here today. But to that extent, you would still have some collection and verification involved in that delegation agreement, I think.
To the extent that it's outside of what the verifications we're providing, so like peer reference, actual follow-up with the peer references.
Right, but I think if they're actually still doing all of the system stuff for the information that they're pulling from our centralized system, then they're still kind of involved in the collection and verification in some way.
Yeah, they would just be cutting the amount of collection and verification they'd be doing because the CBO would be getting our verified data to the extent that it's available. I'm just saying, I was just trying to say that there are examples where that partial delegation would may still exist.
So are you saying you don't want it to exist? You want MOTA to do MOTA and legacy to do legacy?
No, we're not saying we don't want it to exist. I think we're saying that we don't want this external sharing of information, but to the extent that it provides efficiencies and it doesn't conflict with what we're doing program-wide, then okay. I think one of the problems with the delegation agreements was there's no ability to track the relationship. So if you're getting information from our system, and, you know, that's an ownership thing, but if you're sharing it with somebody else, then now it's third-party sharing. And so there's a little bit of a problem with that. And then we can't track the affiliations for the practitioners. We did not want to track the credentialing decision, but we are trying to track the relationship, and so that the folks that are paying for it can have continuous monitoring and all of that. And the cost is the cost is the cost. If other people aren't paying, then the one person has to pay.
The practitioners input that information of who they're credentialed by, right?
Right.
Okay.
So
just thinking about it from like what it currently looks like. So we delegate credentialing to Providence, and you guys send us a roster. And generally within the delegation agreement, there's a requirement of how often that's sent and what information is included.
Sure.
So if that, to kind of take that piece of the ownership of the information, if we could whittle that down to what's in a directory, the statewide directory, that information is going to be shared with anybody using the system anyway. So if they were to, you know, build that delegation agreement around the structure of that information, assuming that it fits the need, then maybe that's sort of just a non-issue.
Is the concern, is your concern then, we don't want the information, delegation isn't that we're then handing copies of those verifications to another organization. They're relying on us or that entity to do that verification work. We don't share it unless there's a need, so an audit or something, and we don't typically give copies of everything we do. We are just giving very limited information to the delegate.
Right, and that's a full delegation. Mm-hmm. And so that's appropriate, and that makes sense because you don't need to get that information from our system because you're getting just the high-level stuff and the approval.
For somebody like CLIPA, when they're doing hospital affiliation verification information, that might not be the case.
I'm just thinking that they have access to the collection and verification. So if Ben Surgery Center says, I still don't want to touch this stuff, so go ahead and be my sub-user, and you can just get the information and verifications from the centralized system for me and put it into the system that we always use, then in that sense, they're still being delegated to that collection and verification. Okay. So it's 11:57. Obviously, I have a lot more work to do here, so Luke and I will probably talk to some of our SMEs, our subject matter experts, to get a little more insight on this. I want to talk to Jen Waite with COIPA and talk about that more, and so we'll come back to this. This is an iterative process, so I know, though, we do have to take something to our advisory group, though, at our June meeting. I think that's June 5th or June 7th. But in any event, we have another RAC scheduled for after that, and I think we'll have a lot of this kind of worked out and probably come back to you that time and hopefully have a lot of it squared away and then can do a notice of proposed past that. If we need to have an additional one, we will. So don't feel like we can't.
Push it to email for public comment.
Right. Do we want to open it up for, we'll open it up for public comment. And we're late in the game for that. I wonder how much public comment we have.
All participants are now in interactive talk mode.
So now we have participants in talk mode, so if anybody has public comments, please speak up. Okay. All right, so with that, we will conclude until next time, our next round of fun. Thank you so much for all your help and support in this.